Hello, I'm Paul Scott, and today I'm talking to Simon Tucker, the Chief Executive of SRT Marine Systems. So, hello, Simon.
Good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
Yeah, very good, very good. So, SRT is listed on AIM with the ticker SRT as well. Quick disclaimers, I'm not charging a fee for doing this interview. I don't hold shares in SRT personally, and I'm not giving financial advice or any sort of recommendations. Okay, so let's start off with the results then, Simon. Your interims came out last week. Now, I've got to be fairly blunt that the figures were not good. I mean, we've got revenues of 2.9 million and a 1.7 million pre-exceptional loss. So, I mean, that was in line with your previous trading update, so there were no surprises there particularly. But, I mean, can you outline really why the interim results were not sort of where you would have hoped them to be, I guess?
Well, the interim results were actually where we expected them to be on our internal budgets. As you know, as an AIM company, we provide via our brokers annual guidance, and the guidance for this year is a £15 million revenue. Of course, I accept that that people want to see, if you're forecasting 15, they want to see 7.5 at the halfway point. The way our business works is that we have three primary revenue lines. We have one, which is our M-Track product line where we sell into dealers and distributors. And that was ahead by 60% year on year. And it'd grown last year by 40%. So actually that growth rate is increasing. Mm-hmm. We have a second product line, which is our OEM and module business, which grew by 10%. And we expect that to continue to grow at that rate. And the third element, which is the bit that everybody always focuses on, is our projects business, where we deliver complete maritime domain awareness systems. And in order for us to recognize revenue on those projects, we must complete deliverables, which then the customer signs off on. And during the first half, we did not complete any deliverables. Therefore, we did not recognize any revenue. But it is very lumpy. And so whilst I understand, you know, how people will look at 2.9 for the first half, that is not indicative of the whole year. Obviously, it would make my job much easier if the deliverables had been completed in the first half and some of the new contracts had started in the first half, and therefore actually we had done 12 in the first half and had three to do in the second half. But equally, that wouldn't be indicative that we would do another 12 in the second half. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. So, I mean, the jump then in H2 revenues is going to be huge, isn't it, if you achieve it? So that's looking at 12.1 million H2 against 2.9 in the first half. I mean, how realistic is that figure, do you think?
Well, there's two things to say. First of all, AIM rules are very clear. If we didn't think we would be meeting or beating our expectations, the minute that happens, we have to announce something. The fact that we haven't announced something would suggest quite clearly that we are very confident. I think that it's also well to remember that unlike our OEM module and M-Track business, the projects business is very lumpy. So the completion of a milestone, let's say, might be the completion of the coast station network in a particular country, might then result in a deliverable which is then worth £4-5 million. It's not an accumulation of lots of little shipments, which is what M-Track and the OEM and module business is. So it's a very different thing. I accept that there is some skepticism around that with some investors because it's, you know, the jam tomorrow and all that sort of stuff until such time as we deliver that. But, you know, we do go into the second half with signed contracts. We do have four project opportunities which are moving towards signing, and I'm happy to go into that in a little bit more detail if you wish. Mm-hmm. So we're cool with it, as they would say.
Okay, oh, that sounds encouraging. So, I mean, probably if we get a couple of reader questions out of the way, which were on the historic numbers and then the interim numbers rather, and then if we can move on then to the sort of the outlook after that. So we've got questions here from Mohit, who says he's really questioning the gross margins. He said your gross margins are stable at 46%.
but the full year gross margin for the prior year was higher at 66%. He says, what caused the decrease in the margins, the gross margin?
That's a good question. Our OEM and module business has the lowest margin of all our revenue streams, which is on average around the 40% mark, and our MTRAP business has a higher margin than that, which is around the sort of 60% mark. So it depends on the weighting of those two, and those two elements comprise the revenue for the first half. The projects business, the systems business, where there's a lot of software, so all systems would comprise of a vessel transceiver, something on the coastline to monitor those transmissions, and a PC with our GeoVis software on to display it, has a much higher software component, and therefore the margin is higher. So this is why we provide the guidance. On average, over the year, you're going to see an average gross profit margin of 50%. Some periods, that's going to be higher because there's the higher element of the systems business. But specifically for the first half in this financial year is because of the lack of completion of deliverables on the systems business.
Yeah, so really, shareholders just have to accept that it's inherently a lumpy business, isn't it, really, which is reflected in the historic figures where you sort of oscillate from profit 1 year to a loss the next year and so on.
I think until such time as we get, which is what we expect to happen pretty soon, until we get a couple of projects and then some more overlapping, so you have multiple projects overlapping, so therefore you have milestones being delivered quarterly, if not monthly, then you are going to get gaps, like long gaps between completion of milestones.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly the attraction of the share for people who are bullish on it is that it's got the potential for explosive upside on profitability, hasn't it? If some of these really big things in the pipeline come through as hoped for.
Well, I'm bound to say yes to that. But let me just sort of, you'd be surprised, especially if you were talking to me, if I didn't. SRT is predicated as an investment case and as an investment case for ourselves in time, as employees and what have you, as to whether countries and authorities are interested in tracking their maritime domain. Mm. We've seen a huge uplift in that in the avionics, flight tracker and all that sort of stuff, because people realize that planes have transponders on them and all that sort of stuff. And in the marine world, most countries have 1980s era surveillance and monitoring systems. Over the last 20 years, new technologies have come in. AIS is one of them. And now they've realized that they're actually the most exposed border is that of their marine EEZ and their coastline. And that is what's driving demand for our system. So, you have to satisfy yourselves with that the demand is there. We foresaw AIS many years ago. We've been in it for a long time. We've established ourselves as the leader. And in the last 3 or 4 years, we've been engaged with those countries working out how they're going to upgrade their systems. Sadly, the conceptual decision of, right, we're going to build a new maritime surveillance system is pretty quick. Then it's all the logistics of how do they do that, which stakeholders are involved. If you take Vietnam as one project opportunity that we're working on at the moment, which is pretty developed, you've got a 3,800-kilometer long coastline, 300 different ports, 60,000 different fishing boats. You have to work all of that, and that does take a long time to do. But we've been doing that for a long time, so we're nearing the end of that conveyor belt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the 60 million contracts in advanced stage then. That was the phrase that really jumped out at me from the interim results. Could you sort of add a bit more color around that?
I can a little bit. We're always constrained, and I know that some people find that irritating, with customers obviously not wanting their plans publicly aired and what have you. So we talk about our validate. We have loads of different opportunities, inquiries all the time from all sorts of different countries. I mean, only last week we quoted several million dollars for an African country that a month earlier we hadn't heard from. That is not in our validated sales pipeline. We try to focus the efforts on our sales team onto the validated sales pipeline, which are those where there's budgets, they've had proposals, we are actually in discussions. Of course, we then want to further focus our time on those in that pipeline that are really close to closing, and there are four of those. And there are two in the Middle East and two in Asia. And in aggregate, they add up to about £60 million. Now, those will, as we expect to sign those, I mean, imminent is a matter of perspective. When we say imminent, in the coming months, and that could be up to 6 months. And then once we sign those, then we will then need to deliver those. And the shortest project in that, those four is over 1 year, and the longest is over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about the imminent, we are at contract discussions stage. We are, you know, we have bits of paper flying backwards and forwards between us, between their legal departments, between their finance departments of governments, so their Treasury and their Ministry of Interiors and Ministries of Agriculture, etc. And we're going through the loop of defining legal terms, commercial terms, and the detailed specifications. And often the biggest hurdle in those discussions is them and us understanding what is the trigger for a delivery of a milestone. Because you're dealing with civil servants in the end. And, you know, for us, we, for example, delivery of a coast station, well, that's very easy conceptually. But for the civil servant, you say, well, what do you mean by delivery of that? Is that to the dock? That's of no use to me. Is it on the tower? How do I know it works, etc.? So it's explaining all of that, and that's what takes a little bit of time. But those four are right at, you know, in the final furlong. Not that I'm a horse.
Okay, so I suppose really, you know, in a way, the structural problem the business has is that handling these government contracts is always going to be slow and prone to delays and cancellations and things, isn't it?
I think they're always prone to delays. I don't think they're prone to cancellations. You know, this is based on a fundamental need to have maritime domain awareness, and almost no country has that today, and the new technologies enable that. That's not to say every country is going to buy from SRT. That would be lovely if they did. I think that we are now at a stage where a lot of the groundwork has been done, all the testing and validation and all that sort of stuff has been done. And so given that we have a relatively small market cap visa, some of these opportunities, once these one, two, three, or four contracts come across the line, we have greater visibility on the milestone deliverables and stuff, I think then people will feel a little bit more relaxed about whether a country signs up in May or September.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Going back then to the email from my blog reader, Mohit, he's asked a couple more questions. And sorry, these are rather dry accounting questions, but I have to ask what the readers ask. He's querying at the high levels of inventories and receivables on the balance sheet. And in particular on receivables, he says that there was a problem in the past with collecting in a $1.5 million debtor, which was written off as in exceptional items in these interim figures. So he just wants to focus on receivables to make sure there are no more sort of potential bad debts in that figure.
Yeah. So on the inventory, a few years ago we stocked up for the U.S. Coast Guard rule, which then came in, and because of no enforcement and continued no enforcement on their part, we still had that inventory. That inventory has come down quite a lot, and actually that inventory is there pending for some of the projects that we've got coming up, as well as being sold through our OEM and our MTRAP business. So that inventory is being sold through. It's not like bananas. It's not like a consumer product where you have the mobile phone version B, but then version C comes out and version B is now obsolete. You know, this stuff doesn't go off and stuff. So that's all saleable stock, and we are selling it through, and we will sell that through. And at the moment, it's going out in drips and drabs, but a couple of the projects that will all be going. And then we'll be on the back foot and have to be making stuff and rushing to do that when you've got long lead times. In regards to the receivable, the first thing is that the receivables – it depends on the reporting time and when we bill, because you might have a milestone which is delivered and then therefore invoiced when immediately before a period end. In regards to the current interims that we've just announced on that receivable there, That is from a customer in the Middle East. They have long payment terms of between 6 and 9 months. That is just a fact of life. And so we're expecting that that money to be paid in this half. The issue with regards to the Southeast Asia contract, where we wrote off £1.5 million, that, as per the press release we put out earlier this year, we were informed by our customer and their end customer, so the Coast Guard in question, that the project was delayed until next financial year, which begins March 2018. We decided, being prudent, that therefore we would write off that receivable, which then enabled us to reallocate that stock to some other projects, which will then come back in due course. So we deemed it prudent to write that off just to keep everything clean. It wasn't because that we didn't think we would be paid ultimately, but it would seem odd to have a receivable for over a year sitting on your balance sheet on a delayed government project. And so we did the right thing. And in fact, our auditors said, no, it's fine, because here is a letter from a government saying it's all right. It's just a delay, which is very normal in these big government projects. And what I would say, Paul, is that we are hitting for the big time as a small company. We have I wouldn't say risky, but we've made some aggressive investments in technology which weren't part of maritime domain awareness at a time when maritime domain awareness wasn't really a market. And these things have now come together. And so, the figures are big in relation to our size, but I think that's what, people are investing for with SRT. They want the big explosive growth, and that comes from having taken some risks. And I think that we're now at the end of that particular conveyor belt.
Okay. And I thought it was impressive the way when you did that bad debt write-off, I believe management gave back the bonuses that you'd received the previous year, didn't you? Or something along those lines.
Yep, we did. Because it's not right to receive bonuses when things, weren't buggered up.
Well done you. I think that's impressive. Now,
it's an obvious thing to do, to be honest. But there we are.
You'd be surprising how few company directors do, though.
I wouldn't, because I'm an investor in some, but there we are. Not at SRT.
Just as you're touching on director and staff shareholdings, have you got a rough figure of what percentage directors and staff personally hold in SRT shareholdings?
I think it's about 4-5% thereabouts.
Okay. Right, sure. Just looking at the other side of the balance sheet then, you put in place quite a large debt facility, which struck me as being a bit pricey, but obviously, was it 10% per annum interest, I think?
Nine,
okay. But I suppose that, the advantage is obviously that it doesn't dilute shareholders, does it? I mean, could you give us a bit of colour on that?
Yes. So I had two messages from shareholders when I spoke to them. One was, you're not sufficiently capitalized. We'll worry about you running out of cash. If there are delayed payments or there are long payment terms as opposed to delayed payment terms, like is typical in places like the Middle East. And then we had other investors saying, I'm worried about dilution. So it's tricky to satisfy both of those. And we came across a group who said they could put together a debt facility for us. It would effectively be an overdraft facility. Mm. And it would enable us to dip into working capital when we needed it. For example, if we enter into a contract, Saudi Arabia, for example, has 12-month payment terms, and it's well known in the industry. And any sort of typical factoring, but it's well known, ask British Aerospace or Lockheed Martin, anybody. That's the reality of it. And, of course, people factor in bridging loans and all that sort of stuff. And they'll cost you 17-18% per annum on an annualized basis. So this was a way of satisfying concerns of shareholders that there might be a dilutive rights issue by saying we now have a working capital facility that enables us to flex with the customers. We don't have to take it all. We pay it back when we want. In fact, we've taken very little of it, and we expect to take very little of it. But it does provide that comfort to shareholders. And I think when you look at it is, yes, it's 9% on an annualized basis when we need it, but if we have it for a few months, actually, it's not very expensive. Mm. The other thing I would say is that if we can't return more than 9% on capital employed on SRT, what are we doing?
Mm.
You know,
yeah, good point.
You know, so the cost of capital and the deploying it, we must be able to get greater than 9%, and we do get a significant greater return than that.
Yeah, okay. I think I've more or less run out of questions, actually, so we didn't really get many in from the blog readers this time. I mean, is there any other topics that you want to cover, Simon?
I think the only other topic is our ocean scan system. I've had some questions as to what the logic of that is. One of the great things and bad things about us is that we have to anticipate and predict what the market's going to need years in the future, because it takes years to develop these products and systems, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the maritime domain awareness world, countries want to see out to 200 miles, systems on the coastline see out to 50 miles. The only way to see that extra 150 miles is by satellite. We have a load of projects that will come in over the next year or so, not least those four in the next few months. And all of those, once the transponders are on vessels and out there, will want to have satellite data to see that extra 150 miles. So by investing in that ocean scan system, our cost of data is negligible, and we sell that into our customers. I think the other thing I'd like to say is that, you know, I understand that from the outside, you know, 6 months must seem like forever to get these things over the line. When you're sitting inside and you're running hard, it seems like a flash. Mm. And do bear in mind that on most of these projects in our validated sales pipeline, we have progressed all the way down the road over all the speed bumps. And in particular, these four where I'm practically commuting to the Middle East and Asia on a weekly basis are very close. Mm. So thank you for those that have stuck with us, and I'm sure they'll be suitably rewarded.
That sounds good. So just on the satellite system then, is that something that's currently in development? And if so, when's the rough sort of launch time on that?
They will be live in Q1 2019, which is mm-hmm. at about the same point where we expect a number of projects to reach critical mass with transceiver deployments on vessels.
Right.
So obviously, in order for there to be something for the satellites to see, there need to be vessels with transceivers. When you're deploying a project, what they normally do is do the control rooms and the coast station systems first. Then they start to deploy the transceivers on boats. That is always the difficult bit because the boat owners don't want them. And if you can imagine, you know, take Vietnam again, you know, along 3,500 kilometers of coastline, tens of thousands of boats, you're trying to actually meet the boat owner and actually put the thing on and all that sort of stuff. That takes a little bit of time. And so 2019 is about the right time.
Mm.
That takes us about a year to build the satellite, integrate the technology. We will have a couple of distinct advantages, one being that the AIS that we will deploy on the satellites, combined with our SatTrack and our transponders, will have a much greater resolution than existing AIS systems. We'll also be able to detect vessels using their wake patterns that don't have AIS, and thirdly, will directly deliver data directly to a customer as opposed to going via somewhere in the United States or Canada or Europe, which actually is very important to countries. They want their own autonomy and to know that their data is coming to them. So we've hired Martin, who's our... we have to call him a mission commander. The titles are fantastic in the satellite industry. So he's mission commander. He's built and run projects for satellite constellations for people like the European Space Agency and others. And he's now motoring with that. And so 2019, we will have a very significant commencement of recurring revenue out of our projects to further smooth that revenue line. And make our forecasts a little bit more predictable and believable.
Yeah, okay. And just on the, I think it's quite interesting that the end customer, well, the individual boat owners sort of tend to resist this because I suppose it costs money to fit a transponder and all the rest of it. Is there an opportunity maybe to sell it to them as being a safety feature, you know, that they could have a sort of a Mayday button that they could press that would pinpoint their position exactly and help, you know, to get rescue services to them?
All our transponders have an SOS button on them, and you're absolutely right. When you're the first thing with all these projects, it's the government buys the transponders and gives them to the boat owner.
Mm.
Most of the boat owners are fishermen who have licenses, and so it's all wrapped up with legislation, which is all part of this project planning, that says if you want a license, you need to have an electronic license tracker, which is an AIS transponder, and that's kind of the end of it. So it's pretty dictatorial, but because it's a regulation. But what they do, and we work with them, is we do try to win the hearts and minds of the fishermen and their families. And you touched on the major selling point, which is you're going to be found when you have a problem. There's huge loss of life amongst fishermen. And in the areas that we operate in, South America, Middle East, Asia, when the man of the household, and it is the man of the household, doesn't come back because the boat is sunk, the family have no means of food, they have no means of shelter, etc.
Yeah.
So it's a major issue. So once you actually explain that to their families, the families do the selling for you.
I see, so, yeah.
But it's a job to be done, and it's a big part of the planning of these things. Now, we've learned a lot. We first learned this in Mexico 5 years ago when we shipped 19,000 transponders, and nobody had thought how they were going to get on, including us. You just thought, well, we just ship them and they magically appear on the boat. Mm-hmm. And we learned that you really have to manage that. And now in Bahrain, where we have a system, it's smoothly run. The vessels have been fitted with them reliably. They don't get smashed up. The fishermen accept them. They want them. And that's operating nicely. And that's one of the reasons why people come to us, because of that knowledge.
Yeah, and I wonder, could there be a special website set up for families to use where they could put in a password and actually track where their husband's boat actually is in real time?
Yep, you should come and do our product management. So, Alex, you're new to this, I assume, unless you've spent weeks looking at our website.
No, I haven't. I'm just thinking
of
my feet.
Well, it's interesting. We have a functionality called VMS Connect, and that basically allows the fishermen to report their catches and all sorts of stuff, but it also allows the fishing families to use local kiosks, because you've got to think a lot of the villages so Philippines is a big project for us at the moment. A lot of these places don't have cellular coverage or anything like that. They don't have smartphones and things. But you put a kiosk in the local fishing port, and people can come down. And they don't use, actually, we don't use passwords. It's all old-fashioned. People are using biometric systems.
Gosh.
So in India, in India, for example, everybody has a identity card with biometric information in it.
Yeah.
So they can do all of that, and they can see where their husband is, etc., when he's coming home, all that sort of stuff. And also, actually, then becomes a benefit to fishermen, because they go out fishing. We assume that they know where they're going. They know they came out of the port, and they normally go left, and they go for about 20 minutes.
Wow.
When you can actually show them a map and says, do you realize that you went there and you caught this amount, and you went over here and you caught that amount? Then they can start to understand better how they're operating.
Yeah,
so there's a number of benefits. So actually, VMS Connect functionality within our GeoVis system enables the fishermen and the fishing authorities to make use of, if you will, big data in their world.
Yeah, I see.
But it's the start. You've then got, you know, fishing pricing, which varies between ports. So one of the big problems is fishermen they don't want to go back to their home port because they think they're getting a poor price for the fish. Harmonization of fishing ports. If you take Philippines, they have 117 registered fishing ports. And actually what the fisheries are trying to do is to say, well, look, just go back to your fishing port. It's a standard price. So if they can see that and they know that, then people start trying to circumnavigate the systems and things, which in turn benefits actually control of fishing and making sure that they don't fish at the wrong periods of time. And the whole thing becomes a more responsible, structured, sustainable thing.
Yeah. Excellent. Oh, that's
but it starts with tracking the boats, and then you start to build up all that functionality.
Yeah, I see. Brilliant. Well, we better leave it there, Simon. Thanks very much for the update and thanks for your time. I know you're away on business at the moment, so it's good that we managed to do this. And
yep.
Talk again in 6 months, I guess. Good
luck.
Don't
catch my plane because they won't wait. Thank you very much for your interest, and thank you to all shareholders that have, cynical or otherwise, that have supported us thus far.
Smashing. Cheers, Simon.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye.